From Washington, VOA presents Issues in the News.
Welcome to Issues in the News. I'm Barbara Slavin, Senior Fellow at the Atlantic Council and Washington Correspondent for El Monitor. Joining me on the show this week are Tim Mack, Senior Congressional Correspondent for The Daily Beast, and Chris Moody, Senior Digital Correspondent at CNN Politics. And here are the issues. The U.S. Navy will escort U.S. flagged ships through the Persian Gulf to prevent Iran from seizing them. Iranian Revolutionary Guards have forced a ship carrying the flag of the U.S. Marshall Islands into Iranian waters over a dispute that appears to be more political than commercial. President Obama welcomed Prime Minister Shinzo Abe of Japan to the White House, but the two failed to resolve trade differences that are key to a wider 12-nation trans-Pacific partnership. In the United States, the death of another black man in police custody led to days of rioting in the city of Baltimore and new questions about race relations, mass incarceration, and endemic urban poverty. The issue has entered the U.S. presidential campaign as Democratic hopeful Hillary Clinton bemoaned the fact that the United States, with only 5% of the world's population, has almost 25% of the world's prison population, many jailed for minor offenses. Well, Tim, let's start in the Persian Gulf with the curious case of the Maersk Tigris. This is a commercial ship that the Iranians forced from the Straits of Hormuz into Iranian waters. They say it involved a legal dispute that is 10 years old, that the owner of the ship owes some Iranian company money for some missing containers that were supposed to be delivered to Dubai. But the timing of this suggests that maybe there was another motive.
Yes, well, this is obviously a time of increased tension in that general area, so firing upon and seizing a ship seems to be as much about a political message as it is about some petty and decade-old commercial issue. Right now, we have some serious problems and instability in Yemen. Right now, we have an American-led, or I would say a world-led, negotiation with Iran in order to come to some sort of nuclear arrangement by June. This is a time of incredible instability in the region. The United States has been unable or unwilling in various cases to tamp down on it, and Iran is trying to send a message.
Yeah. Well, of course, freedom of navigation is very important. Chris, the Strait of Hormuz, 20% of the world's oil flows through the Strait of Hormuz. Just a few days prior to this incident, the U.S. sent a carrier group into the Persian Gulf and turned back an Iranian flotilla that looked like it was en route to Yemen. So it does seem as though there's a bit of tit for tat here.
As Tim mentioned, context is very important here. And if you look at it from the domestic point of view, President Obama has been coming under so much fire from the Republican opposition on trying to find a deal with Iran on nuclear power. And I think this will only fan the flames and give them more encouragement, I think, and say, look, see, we cannot trust the Iranians, or this is not a good time for a deal, or you gave too much on the deal because this is what they're doing. We saw with a lot of the presidential contenders talking about this, or talking about the nuclear deal, and saying we need to slap on the harshest sanctions on Iran. I mean, when something like this happens, I think you're just giving more ammunition to the opposition of the deal, and that's coming mostly from the Republicans in this case, and some Democrats.
No, I would agree with you. I mean, anything that smacks of taking hostages, that always touches a nerve for the United States, given our experience with Iranians. I was in New York when the Iranian foreign minister, Javad Zarif, he was there for a nuclear nonproliferation treaty review conference, but he gave a very long interview at a public event at New York University, and he said, oh, don't read too much into this. Well, of course, he's not in control of what the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps decides to do in the Persian Gulf. And, on the nuclear front, though, things do seem to be moving along, Tim. The negotiations have now restarted to finalize this deal by June the 30th, and Zarif was pretty bullish that a deal would be reached. From a congressional perspective, of course, there's still some attempts we see in the Senate to put amendments onto legislation that could complicate things. But what's your sense of whether this deal is going to get done, at least from the U.S. side?
Well, yeah, I mean, the negotiating parties, that is, the Obama administration and Zarif and his cohorts, are very bullish about getting a deal done. But of course, that's what they would have to say in the days leading up to any final negotiation. Congress, on the other hand, you're right, they're trying to complicate things. I don't think they're necessarily feeling as if this effort could sink a deal. What they want to do is for Congress to be able to review a deal and reject the lifting of sanctions if they don't feel certain conditions are met. Now, those conditions are still being worked out in Congress right now, and that's kind of getting a little messy, as congressional actions usually do. But I don't think that it's going to be determinative as to whether a deal will succeed or fail.
Yeah, well, Zarif, you know, used, this is sort of his standard line, that this is up to the President of the United States, Chris, to get this through. And he pointed out, and he made a couple of jabs at Senator Tom Cotton of Arkansas, that this deal would be codified in a UN Security Council resolution and that even the U.S. Senate could not defy international law.
And those jabs evoked an interesting response from Senator Tom Cotton, who went on Twitter and put a series of tweets tagging Zarif's name and saying, "I will debate you anytime, anywhere on the Constitution." It was a very strange...
He also, in a way, a
nerd duel of debate, I suppose. I don't see that happening anytime soon, but I would pay money if I could see it.
He also challenged Zarif's patriotism, pointing out that Zarif had not fought in the Iran-Iraq War. Zarif, of course, was in the United States getting a PhD in international law during the 80s, and he was also helping to represent Iran at the United Nations. But I thought that was an interesting comment. Zarif, who is a consummate diplomat, turned it around. I think apparently Tom Cotton's recently, his wife's recently had a new baby, and he congratulated him on that and basically did not take the bait, which is something we should all learn on Twitter, not to to take the bait when people try to aggravate you.
When trolled, troll back.
Well, when trolled, respond with kindness, I suppose.
Which is a form of trolling, really.
I suppose. But it was interesting. The whole event was quite interesting because Zarif danced around many of the questions on human rights and on Iran's involvement in the region, including Yemen. And he was very quick to say that the Saudis and the others had supported groups that were on the wrong side of history. Unlike Iran, you know, which of course is supporting such wonderful people as Bashar al-Assad in Syria. Anyway, it was an interesting conversation, and we will see what its result will be. Time now for a short break. We'll be right back with more Issues in the News.
Voice of America's news, talk, and music programs are now at the tip of your fingers. Find everything at www.voaafrica.com. Listen to VOA's program lineup live anytime, day or night. Pick out your favorite shows and listen anytime you want. Download our podcasts. Check VOA Mobile from your cell phone. Subscribe to VOA Newsfeed. VOAnews.com.
Welcome back to Issues in the News on VOA. I'm Barbara Slavin with Chris Moody and Tim Mack. And we're going to move now from Iran and the nuclear negotiations to Japan. Chris, President Obama welcomed Prime Minister Shinzo Abe at the White House. They seemed to bond over a tour of the Lincoln Memorial. Abe got a state dinner and a new defense pact, it seems, with the United States. But the main issue between the U.S. and Japan has to do with trade. And it doesn't seem as though there was a resolution to disputes that involve U.S. cars and farm products. What does this mean for the Trans-Pacific Partnership, the TPP?
I think the question of trade, as much as it is negotiating between countries, it's also negotiating within our own country here in the United States. President Obama has to navigate a tricky labyrinth in getting something like this passed. What he would like is, of course, is a fast track so he can put a deal before Congress, have it voted on without allowing them to make amendments so he can move forward on this. But there are some interesting alliances happening against it right now. For the trade pact, you're seeing big business, congressional Republican leaders, and President Obama all together. And then against it, you have liberals like Elizabeth Warren and in the House of Representatives, Tea Party Republicans. So that is a tough needle to thread when you're trying to make policy, especially on an international scale, when there's so many moving parts abroad. There's also many of those at home.
Yeah. Tim, a little bit more about the interplay in Congress now. Is this going to get through?
Yeah, I mean, I think Chris makes a really excellent point, and the president has to navigate this strange coalition. He's never been known to be a very good political coalition maker when it comes to strange coalitions. He's always been good at kind of firing up his own base. That's how he got elected, but he's never been good at kind of working with John Boehner, for example, or, you know, big business. That's not been his forte. One of the big reasons for the opposition from the left is decline of American manufacturing, and a big part of Obama's base has been those unions that have worked out in middle America and worked those union jobs. They're not going to be supportive of a deal that opens up trade that creates manufacturing competition from Japan or China or that what else. But I think from a larger perspective, the president really has staked much of his administration when it comes to Asia policy on what he called originally the Asia pivot, or right, the rebalancing towards Asia. And his administration has really been hassled entire time by a focus on the Middle East due to events totally out of his control. And he's been unable to execute on that sort of rebalancing, which this partnership would want to do. That's really what his legacy on Asia is going to hinge on.
In terms of the defense component, I guess there are messages being sent to China in some of what was discussed with Abe. Certainly that side of the U.S.-Japan relationship appears very solid, Chris.
China plays a very big role in these negotiations on trade because it allows the United States to have commerce with countries all around it, of course, and kind of neutralizes China, or at least takes away a little bit of their power, which I think is a sell that President Obama can make, especially to the Republicans in the House of Representatives, saying, look, you've been telling me to be tougher on China this whole time. Here is an opportunity where we can do that. Whether they will respond generously to that, is obviously yet to be seen, but probably not going to happen.
Yeah. Tim, you mentioned manufacturing jobs, and that's, I think, a very good segue into our next topic, which is the incredible unrest that we're seeing now in a number of American cities over the deaths of African Americans who are either shot by the police or die in custody or die in some mysterious circumstances that involve law enforcement. Of course, the latest example was in Baltimore, a young man, Freddie Gray, who had a fatal spinal injury when he was being transported in a van after being arrested by police, was in a police van. The city of Baltimore is supposed to be known as Charm City, but it wasn't very charming, was it?
No, not this week. On Saturday, Monday, and on Tuesday, violence broke out on the streets. Widespread looting, attacks on police officers involving bricks and cinder blocks. Just a lot of chaos. And I was down there on Monday and Tuesday evening reporting. There's just so much anger, and it can't really be expressed in rational ways, you know, that, you know, it makes no sense to destroy the community you live in to express frustration about someone who a lot of these people on the street actually know. I mean, these are young kids, some of whom said, I knew Freddie Gray, he was a good guy, I'm extremely angry, and followed by a bunch of expletives towards police. I mean, that's basically what this comes down to. It's urban poverty, a lack of options, a lack of hope, and injustice on top of it, and no way out of it.
Chris, Hillary Clinton gave a speech this week that was very moving, where she talked about mass incarceration. She basically talked about an entire generation that has been warped by mass incarceration for really minor offenses. And she had some absolutely staggering statistics. She said one out of every 28 children in our country has a parent in jail. She said that in Baltimore, between a sort of upper middle class district and the area where these disturbances took place, there's a 20-year difference in life expectancy. I mean, it's as though, you know, you have this part of the United States, a developed country on one side, and a third world country on another. One in three young black men in Baltimore can't find a job. I mean, this is incredible. And obviously, this is not something that just developed over the last couple of days or years. It's a product of policies and of a situation that's existed for a long time.
There's something very interesting going on in American politics, and that is a bipartisan repudiation of the way we handle crime and incarceration. I think a lot of people would say to Mrs. Clinton, welcome to the party on reform on this, because it, her husband, President Bill Clinton, played a large role in passing a lot of these policies that were well-intentioned but had unintended consequences especially on communities of color. Now, in the past couple of years, on the Republican side and Libertarian side, there's been a lot of talk about reforming those laws, a lot of surprising people coming out and saying we need to change these things. People from the Reagan administration, the Koch brothers, the billionaire donor mm-hmm. network, are putting lots of money into incarceration reform. Freedom Works, which is a Tea Party organization, has partnered with the Center for American Progress on this. And so we're seeing a rush to try to find a way to fix these problems. And what we saw in Baltimore was not just because of a young man being killed. It was scratching the surface of such deeper problems that you mentioned in those startling statistics.
Yeah.
And just now, policy, sometimes it takes a while for things that are happening on the ground to get to policymakers, but the message is heard. And I think in the presidential race coming up, you're going to see Republicans and Democrats saying the same or at least very similar things on reforming our incarceration laws.
Yeah. Tim, you mentioned, you know, why would people burn down their own communities? But, you know, when you have no other way to dramatize your plight, sometimes that's the way you call and obviously have called attention and nationwide attention to these problems. Chris mentioned some of the policies of President Bill Clinton. In 1994, he was supporting something called the Violent Crime Control and Law Enforcement Act, which created tougher penalties for drug offenders and devoted $30 billion to put more police officers on the street and build new prisons. And then under the Reagan administration, there was also the war on drugs, which basically scooped up people. And if you were an African-American caught with a very small amount of illegal drugs, you went to jail. But if you were a white person, that didn't happen to you.
Yeah, I mean, one of the problems that this bipartisan coalition has identified is the issue of overcriminalization, whether even every offense warrants jail time, whether there are better ways to mediate the issue. If you get caught with a small amount of drugs, does that mean you should go to jail for a year? Should we crowd our prisons with all the costs that involves? And should we radicalize youth by sending them to jail where they come back out angrier than before?
Yeah, hold that thought. Time for another break. We'll be right back with Issues in the News.
Here's a quick quiz. What do the letters LTATOMLAW stand for? We know the answer, right? Listen to Akwe Thompson on Nightline Africa Weekends. Add to that 16 and 18 UTC on VOA, and we have a perfect score. That was easy.
Welcome back. I'm Barbara Slavin with Chris Moody and Tim Mack, and we're talking about mass incarceration in the United States. Chris, I recently read an excellent book that was actually suggested to me by my 25-year-old son, and it's called The New Jim Crow. What it calls sort of a way of reinstituting the racial discrimination, Jim Crow laws refer to the resegregation that occurred in the South after the Civil War. And the contention of the author of this book is that the criminal justice system has been used to reinstitute two classes, two worlds, one for poor African Americans and one for the rest, using the criminal justice system. And indeed, the percentage of African Americans who've been affected by the criminal justice system in an extremely negative way is very large, as I pointed out earlier. Do you think this is going to figure? You mentioned that it'll figure in the campaign, but this issue specifically, I wonder if it's a way that Republicans may try to attract some support from minority communities in the U.S.
Well, it already has. You've seen Rand Paul, when he announced his presidential campaign, saying that any laws that disproportionately affect minority communities should be repealed, which I don't think he means that exactly. But I think looking at this issue through the prism of, I think the most potent example is the drug war. If you look at Freddie Gray's rap sheet, and it was a long rap sheet, most of the things he was arrested for had to do with narcotics. People say marijuana is a gateway drug. Well, the drug war really is a gateway into more crime, and it is what brought him into the criminal justice system and kept him cycling in and out. Some really startling statistics. Between 2001 and 2010 here in the United States, just on marijuana alone, there were more than 8 million arrests. In the U.S., Black Americans were 3.7 times more likely to be arrested than white Americans, even though whites and blacks use marijuana at about the same rates. Further, take it even smaller, in the District of Columbia, blacks were eight times as likely to be arrested. And I will tell you, white people in D.C. smoke marijuana as much as black people. Now, in Washington, D.C., that has really changed because the city has legalized.
Well, it's trying to legalize. I'm not sure Congress is allowing. But
The larger point here is that, yes, in the thesis of the new Jim Crow, there have been laws that have disproportionately affected minority communities and kept them in a state that doesn't allow them to rise up economically. And in with that context, we can see why, when things like Freddie Gray happen or other examples, why they rise up in the streets, not to justify violence of any kind.
Sure.
But certainly this community is really crying out for an opportunity. And with the presidential campaign, you're going to see these candidates trying to give them a way to have that opportunity.
Yeah. Tim, reading about Freddie Gray and his life, in a sense, he was a victim of drugs involuntarily from his earliest days, because apparently the house that he grew up had flaking lead paint all over the place. It was a dilapidated house, and he ingested the lead, and so his mental capacity was probably affected from a very young age. He had attention deficit disorder caused by lead poisoning.
Yeah. And, you know, I mean, a stunning amount of children from that neighborhood in West Baltimore have lead poisoning. 7% of all the population, including adults, has lead poisoning, which measures more, scores more than you would find just across town in East Baltimore, where lead poisoning is almost unheard of. And so, I mean, this is the situation that Freddie Gray grew up in. And you have to wonder, though, I mean, it's an environment where, you know, you look at the situation that led to his death. He wasn't doing anything wrong. He was standing on the street, his eyes locked with a police officer, and something led him to think, I've got to start running. You know, I don't want to be here. So he takes off, and that's what leads to a fatal encounter with the police. We still don't know what caused the spinal injury that ultimately killed Freddie Gray. And I think that's what's leading to so much uncertainty and anger in Baltimore right now, because a lot of people on the ground just want a very simple answer. Mm-hmm. What happened?
I mentioned Hillary Clinton's speech. This was at Columbia University. It was quite extraordinary and heartfelt, and it seems that this is going to be a major element of her campaign. Chris, maybe you could talk a little bit more about how other candidates now are approaching the issue, and also what seems to be popping up now on the Republican side as major issues.
A lot of these Republicans that are about to launch presidential campaigns, or already have been talking about this for a couple of years now, and not just talking about it, but also doing something about it in the capacities that they have. We mentioned Rand Paul. He has sponsored or co-sponsored a handful of bills on this issue, on incarceration, on reforming drug laws. Co-sponsoring a bill doesn't mean it gets passed. It's a lengthy process. But you also have governors, or Republican governors around the state. Mm-hmm. Bobby Jindal in Louisiana has looked at different ways of approaching drugs. Rick Perry on incarceration and prison reform. And New Jersey Governor Chris Christie has made it a huge push to change the way they approach addiction, especially for heavy drugs like heroin, although he is not necessarily willing to address marijuana legalization for his own reasons. But it is certainly a complete turnaround from what we experienced in the way policymakers approached this in the 1980s and 1990s. They've realized that the unintended consequences do not necessarily outweigh the good intentions that these people, these policymakers, had. And now we have, as we mentioned earlier on the show, a massive incarceration rate in the so-called freest country in the world.
Yeah, it's something that foreign leaders often point out, I must say, when the United States criticizes their human rights policies. Hillary Clinton talked about 1.5 million missing African American men, missing husbands, missing fathers, missing brothers. And of course, the impact of that on families is devastating.
And the impact on your future. In the District of Columbia, if you have an arrest in your past, it's very difficult to get into subsidized housing. Because it might have happened 15 years ago. You might have been a child and you made a mistake. These are things that have repercussions for the rest of their lives. And then they go on to the next generation and the next generation.
Right.
It makes it so cyclical.
You can't get government benefits. You also can't vote, which means you are in effect disenfranchised, which was why I think the author of The New Jim Crow talked about this as being a kind of resegregation of the country, Tim.
Yeah, I mean, this, its very base is about two things: powerlessness, hopelessness, and about interactions and mistrust with law enforcement. When you grow up in a community like Freddie Gray did, where a third of all houses are abandoned, nothing in them, mm-hmm. no hope, no economic prosperity at all or opportunity, what happens to you? This is what happens.
Yeah. Well, that's all the time we have. Joining us today were Tim Mak, senior congressional correspondent for The Daily Beast, and Chris Moody, senior digital correspondent at CNN Politics. This program was produced by Anya Zalewski. Our engineer was Justin Thwaites. I'm Barbara Slavin, senior fellow at the Atlantic Council and Washington correspondent for Al Monitor. Thanks for listening.